pouring myself some of this wine.
No, see, this water here, very mouth-filling, because I only take enormous gulps of water.
Just razzing me all day about mouth-filling.
Mouth is very full.
This is why nobody likes you.
Because of this?
It's this right here.
The behavior?
Your semantic nonsense.
I mean, I was looking for a solution for a long time, and I think we found it. So It's the semantics that did it.
Yeah.
It's not my face or my general demeanor or my beliefs or the sins. It's just semantics.
Giving people shit for
about their word choices.
Specific word choices, yeah.
Yeah, I guess people don't really care for that, do they?
No, they hate it. They really hate it. But I have found in my life of also kind of being a semantic pain in the ass.
I was going to say, like, to counter, what if they could just
be better?
Be more careful in how they choose their words.
Right. That would be nice. Although I still maintain that mouth filling was appropriate and you're a bitch. Welcome, everyone.
Welcome.
To You're Gonna Need a Bigger Bottle. It's a podcast about wine and movies.
You know what? I'm gonna give it to you this time. Movies are gonna get the and credit, which is more significant. Wine above the title, and credit, though everybody remembers the and credit.
This is exactly what the fuck I'm talking about.
And movies. A podcast about wine, featuring semantics with bits and movies. Introducing Scott and Jamie.
I got to give you that one. A round of applause for Scotty.
I like the credit.
It was a good one. We like it. Yep. Thank you very much. So for those of you who don't know anything about one or both of these topics, my name is Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
Wait, hang on. You need to take that back because it makes it seem like the topics that they don't know anything about are you and wine guys. just restate. Whatever. It's a podcast about wine and movies.
We already did this. I'm Jamie. I'm the wine guy.
I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. And this is a podcast for people who don't know shit about wine or movies or both. See, it was just that easy. You can just get off the script and you can just do it.
This double recording session is already.
Yeah.
We're not even through the intro.
That's right.
And we're just beating each other up.
Well, you're not beating me up. You're just being bad and I'm telling you to be better and you're taking offense to that.
Fucking finish your line.
Oh yeah. I'm Scott. I'm the movie guy. We're here to help. Each episode, we recommend a movie that I love and a wine that he loves.
And we fill in the gaps you might not already know. Hopefully, we find that the pairing works. Sometimes, frequently, we don't.
We're like, what, 50-50 at this point?
Sure.
It's a good thing neither of us is tracking it, because certainly nobody else is tracking it.
I hope someone out there has a spreadsheet.
That would be very encouraging and flattering and weirdly sad.
Yes, all of those things.
For that person and for us. Well, to that one listener out there who's tracking things, you already know that this episode here is the fourth installment in our ongoing miniseries, The United States versus James J. Rubin, A People's History, Wine on the Vine, Go Big or Die Winin'. That's the name of our miniseries. Jamie calls it Jamie's History of Wine in America or something, but I think mine is better.
I think everyone that you've written has been better, and I'm really ashamed.
Oh, for sure.
Oh, God. The next miniseries I take the lead on, I'm really going to have to nail down a good title.
Yeah. What are we drinking today, James?
We're drinking some Finger Lakes Riesling. So this is from Keuka Lake Vineyards, the producer at the southern tip of Keuka Lake in New York, a little town called Hammondsport. This is their dry Riesling. It's the entry level, vintage 2018, available at Astor Wine and Spirits for $22 plus shipping. You could also order direct from the winery if that's your thing. So this winery was founded in the late 90s by Mel Goldman and his wife, Dorothy. Their first commercial vintage was 2005. They purchased about 35 acres, like I said, in Hammondsport, New York. They focus mostly on Riesling, though they bottle plenty of wines from Cabernet Franc and a varietal called Vignoles, which is a hybrid variety. If you're looking for a really great Thanksgiving wine, I would recommend their Vignoles. It's delicious. In stark contrast to the last wine, the last winery that we were dealing with.
Dash Cellars,
yes.
Of their famed Jammies Infandel.
That's correct. This is an estate winery, meaning that they grow all of the grapes that go into their wine. Currently, Mel Goldman, the owner, serves as the vineyard manager. His winemaker's name is Ben Sherman. And friend of mine, Katie Cochran, is cellar master and marketing manager. They're a really great team. They make delicious wines. The goal here is to produce dry wines with a focus on single vineyards, including their Falling Man and Turkey Run vineyards. This is the entry-level Riesling. Once again, this is the same deal as in the last episode. Entry-level doesn't mean less good. The best way to think of it is less age-worthy. To be drunk now. Buy a bottle, drink a bottle. Though I do think that this wine could have some life to it. It's totally dry, high acid, citrus driven, a ton of minerality. There's a really interesting texture to it on the palate, which we'll discuss because that was one of the pairing words that I used. But I think that texture really calls attention to the minerality and plays into the perception of it. It's a little bit astringent in all of the best ways possible. There's a lot of tension here.
Well, James, what words did you use when you described this wine for me so that I could pair a movie to it?
I told you about this wine when old school becomes new school, screeching, textural, and expressive.
Yes. And some of these sound like they might even describe the taste of the wine.
That is true.
Well, based on those words and or phrases, I paired
this fucking movie.
So we're talking about The Lighthouse today. This is yet another great 2019 movie that we're covering on the show.
Yeah.
So this one is directed by Robert Eggers of The Witch or The Vitch fame, depending on how one pronounces it. It's written by Eggers and his brother Max. It stars Robert Pattinson and Willem Dafoe as two lighthouse workers or wikis in the late 19th century, assigned to spend 4 weeks together maintaining a remote offshore lighthouse. They get cabin fever in a bad way. They drink way too much. Their relationship is toxic. And there's some weird, like, nautical myth fuckery, including, spoilers, mermaid sex. Sex with a mermaid by a normal non-mer human male.
Though that is in a dream sequence.
Maybe.
Right. Also, maybe they're the same person.
Oh, no, that's not true.
You don't think so?
No, I don't think so. But I also don't really care what the movie's about. Like, I really just want to talk about what it looks like and what it sounds like and what it feels like.
And what it feels like, for sure. I maintain that there's a possibility.
There's a doppelganger.
That they're actually the same person.
They give you a setup for a doppelgangeriness. I think I don't think you need to read it that literally, but there's breadcrumbs there.
There are.
Anyway, yeah, Pattinson fucks a mermaid. It looks like 1920s German silent expressionism. It sounds like an artsy-fartsy horror movie score. The two leads are both going bigger and broader than you've ever seen either one of them go. It's gorgeous and it's crude and it's shockingly violent and graphically sexual. And it is funny in the darkest way. And I love it. I think it's great. I don't know if it's this dry Riesling, but I fucking love this movie. It premiered at Cannes in 2019. It was released in the U.S. by A24, who has come up several times on this podcast before.
A bunch of times. We've done a bunch.
So Swiss Army Man is A24. I am not encyclopedic about what we've done on the show.
Neither am I. I speak it out into the world and then it leaves my brain.
Swiss Army Man is A24. First Cow is A24. Under the Silver Lake was A24. So this is our fourth A24 movie. It feels like more.
It does. Only it definitely feels like more.
Well, it's just because they're great and I talk about them all the time.
And you talk about whenever it's A24, you talk about them.
Well, because they're exciting. They're a very exciting distributor. But yeah, so released by A24, it was well-liked by critics, currently maintains a 90% on the Rotten Tomatometer. It won two awards at the Independent Spirit Awards for Dafoe as supporting actor and for cinematographer Jaron Blaschke. Blaschke was also nominated at the Oscars, but he lost to Roger Deakins and his extremely showy cinematography on 1917.
Sounds like you've got opinions.
I like that movie. I like what Deakins did with it. But like in terms of visual storytelling and visual artistry, this is so much, much more impressive than what that movie pulled off. This is a good movie. This is a really good movie. And I like it. And it's pretty. And it's weird. And it's ugly. And I think people will probably like it and probably won't find it as funny as I do and will definitely be repulsed by it in ways that I find funny.
There are probably a lot of people out there who will not like this movie at all. I don't even know where to begin with how this movie makes me feel. I feel like we should do our takes on the wine before we get into the movie first.
Sure, whatever.
I think it's delicious. Obviously, I think all of the wines that I've chosen are delicious, and that's beyond dispute. No further questions.
Well, what about the ones that taste bad, though?
All of them taste good.
Except for those two that tasted bad.
But they taste really good.
But, Jamie, there were some that I didn't like that I acknowledged that other people could enjoy, but then there were those two that were bad that no one likes.
Plenty of people like them. I, for one, like them.
There's no accounting for taste, as they say.
As they say, this one for me represents what is currently happening and currently exciting about the Finger Lakes broadly. The Finger Lakes have long struggled with having any kind of like a cohesive image or brand or style of wine. There have been producers who do more hybrid varieties or more like fruit wines, like sweet stuff that we don't classically consider to be fine wine. Then there are producers who are more in the German style with some amount of residual sugar to their Riesling. And it feels like there's more of a consensus now than there has been about the quality and the potential of dry wines and specifically dry Riesling. In my wine circles, we would call this more of an Alsatian or an Austrian expression of the grape. It has this sort of stunning acidity that really balances the ripeness that the grapes achieve. I think that there's a lot of aromatic intensity on this wine, and that's one of the things that I really love about it. Ties into one of the words that I use to describe it, which is expressive. I can smell the wine from the glass even when the glass is not directly up to my nose. It's sort of perfuming the area around it.
All right. So I'm about, what is that, maybe 6 inches. I got the glass about 6 inches away from the nose. Yeah, I'm getting a little bit.
Yeah.
I can smell it a little bit that way.
It's vibrant and it goes into the more aromatic parts of the grape. Riesling does have a tendency to get a little bit floral when it gets ripe enough. And this wine has like an elderflower kind of hibiscus character to it that I really love. And it seems like consensus is growing. It seems like producers are communicating more with one another in the Finger Lakes. And I'm excited to see what happens as this sort of coalesces. Because the Finger Lakes have been making wine for a long time, but have struggled to make the kind of name for themselves the way the Napa Valley has, the way Willamette Valley has, the way other American or Australian wine regions have. So Scotty, what do you think of it? Like this wine is, I feel like, on the edge of what you might enjoy.
No, I was down with this wine.
You like it a lot?
I had a good time with it. I put away most of a bottle. I will say I liked it more the other day than I'm liking it now. Maybe it's your...
Yeah, you had the open bottle. How long has that bottle been open?
Today's Tuesday. I opened it Sunday.
Yeah, I mean, it should be holding up.
Yeah, it's not... I'm not getting some of the same notes. That's interesting. Anyway, two nights ago, I enjoyed it quite a bit. Today, maybe a little bit less so. I also didn't have it chilled the other day. It was just room temp the other day. And I did enjoy it quite a bit more. But you think these should be served chilled?
Not necessarily. I mean,
you put it in the fridge.
Yeah, I mean, it can be room temp. It can be chilled. I like it chilled. And, you know, it's the fucking summertime. I like a chilled glass of wine.
Right. Yeah, I haven't liked it as much as probably the other Rieslings that we did on the show. Maybe getting a little bit ahead of ourselves here. But I was getting that laser beam thing that you described several episodes ago with a Riesling. Where you have that laser beam thing that's like you get a zing that you can feel it traveling across your tongue.
Straight down.
Straight down. That I experienced with this wine.
And did you enjoy that experience?
Yeah.
Cool.
On the old nostrils, I was getting some lemon zest and lemon rind. And then I have a little note here that just says, I am congested. And then on the old mouth tasting mechanism, I was getting a sweet tart finish, something that was chalky and sour.
Yeah.
And I was getting laser beams.
So the lighthouse.
Yeah.
What the fuck?
I've been pretty clear that I like it.
I don't care about whether you like it or not. My question is, what the fuck?
What do you mean, what the fuck? What's the what the fuck for? What's so hard to understand about why somebody would want to watch this movie? My thing with this movie is like, I don't know. You're probably going to want to talk about like the plot or like the themes or the symbols or what it means.
And I have no agenda here.
Okay, good. But you're like a plot guy though. Like you don't come no, at it
I'm
from
not,
the same.
I'm a character guy.
Sometimes you're a plot guy.
Sometimes.
Right. Character.
I do prefer to talk about character.
Right.
I like things that have characters, which is why I don't like Christopher Nolan, because he has never written a character in his life.
I don't think that's fair, but I don't want to get into it again. I'm not interested. Not that I'm not interested, but like I didn't pick this movie for its literary qualities. for its narrative, for its characterizations necessarily, or for its themes or allegories, or even for its meaning. Like, I honestly couldn't even necessarily tell you what happens in the last 10 minutes of the movie, except that I have like a series of intense sensory memories of it. For me, it's just pure cinema. It is all about how images and sounds can work together to create a crazy fucking experience.
Mm,
and
it's pure cinema.
It is. It is.
Cinema.
Plot is a distraction from cinema, I think.
Wow. Hot take from Scotty.
All right. Can you make a movie without a plot?
Yes.
Can you make a movie without pictures and sounds?
No.
This is all I'm saying. I'm fine with plotless things.
Yeah.
Not that this is plotless, but like the thing that I'm really drawn to in this movie is just the unbelievable way that it looks and it sounds, and the way that those things come together to create an intense, at the very least, like you have an intense visceral reaction to it, yeah, if not also an intense emotional reaction to it.
Very true.
Also, and this is what I thought Jamie was really going to love for it, and this is really me patronizing you a little bit, but I figured—
You patronizing me?
I know.
That has never happened.
But I figured that like you would really be on board with any movie that features as much farting as this one has.
I did love the farts.
You loved all the farts. Can I tell you a little bit about the farts? Just like a little bit.
Please tell me about that. I didn't know that there was more to talk about other than Willem Dafoe farts a ton.
All the farts are scripted, like specifically scripted, where every single one is placed in dialogue scenes. Dafoe says, depending on the interview that you read, that he is responsible for between half and all of the farts that you hear in the movie. The assistant picture editor claims that during Foley sessions, she was making
the hand fart.
Hand fart noises, and that's what the farts are. The lead Foley supervisor claims that he has a different answer for it.
So they're mythologizing the fart sounds in this
movie. No, it's just that nobody knows. The supervising sound editor, Damien Volpe, says that he is the only one who actually knows how the fart sounds were created. And Jamie, he says he will take the secret to his grave.
That's so bizarre. That's so fucking bizarre.
That is all I have to say about the farts. Okay. It's just that they were scripted. They were very important and intentional. And other than one, the senior sound supervisor, no one knows how they were created for the film.
Okay, so no more about the farts?
I mean, we'll probably have to talk about the farts at least a few more times.
There are more things to say.
I know that you loved and cherished every single squeaky wet one of them.
Sure did.
You have thoughts and feelings on this movie?
I don't know that I have thoughts, but I definitely have feelings. It's visceral. It's exactly as you put it. It's a series of images and sounds that, yeah, that produce sort of a feeling in you. I mentioned to you off mic that the first 45 or so minutes of it were beginning to grate on me. I was beginning to get bored and annoyed. And then I realized somewhere probably around the 40-minute mark, they're starting to wrap up the story. You know, they're about to leave the island. The tender ship is coming back. And I looked at the time code and realized that I had more than an hour left in the movie. And I was like, oh, something is probably going to happen.
Right. And then something happens.
All of the things happen. So the back half of the movie is just this insane ride that I didn't blink.
You can't take your eyes off of it.
No.
It's just so arresting to look at, first of all.
It's such a unique experience. I've never seen anything like it. I really loved it. I will be watching it again. In our last episode, the complaint was raised that you've been picking dour, difficult, devastating movies.
Yeah.
And this, while it's not an easy watch, is not devastating.
I mean, I don't know. I guess it depends on spoilers. Spoilers, everyone. Spoilers for the plot of The Lighthouse. I guess your level of devastation entirely depends on how attached you are to the Dafoe character having, you know, still being alive and not having his head exploded by the end of the movie.
Well, I mean, or also the Pattinson character also still being alive. I guess he's alive, but he's fucking Prometheus style laid out getting picked on by fucking seagulls.
It's pretty great.
The birds in this movie. Oh my God, the fucking birds.
See, you think you don't ever seen anything like this before. And I'll give you a pretty. So this is a dangerous comparison to throw around for anything, because if you compare anybody's work to this particular filmmaker, it sounds like you don't know what the fuck you're talking about. But I genuinely think that there is a quality to Eggers's two movies, The Witch and The Lighthouse, that is Kubrickian.
Interesting.
In two ways. One is that neither of them, and we'll talk about this a little bit more when we get to expressionistic, but neither of them is interested in naturalism whatsoever. They both have very, very consistent, like, formal techniques that they apply. Like, there's very consistent framing in their movies. Both of their films can have an overwhelming, like, tension, and there's a precision, and they're both, by all accounts, perfectionists, and that translates in the work. They're singular experiences, but I do see a lot of parallels from Eggers to Kubrick. I would say the Lighthouse is not, they're not similar, but the emotional and visceral experience, I would say you could put next to something like A Clockwork Orange, something which is like violent and repulsive and alienating to all of your sensibilities, but darkly and weirdly funny and also beautiful and like a formalist exercise.
Huh. I don't have any rebuttal other than having seen both of those movies. I don't agree.
That's fine.
I don't think the vocabulary to construct this argument. But I do see the parallel that you're talking about between the directors, not necessarily between those films.
Yeah. The movies are radically different, but the approach feels very, very similar in the two of them.
I still haven't seen any movie like this. I really loved it. It's something totally new. It was exciting. I had trouble going to bed afterwards, not because I was horrified, but because I was excited.
That's a really intimate, and I'm really surprised that you would share that with me, Jamie, that you would share that secret.
Are you making a masturbation joke right now?
No, I'm surprised, Jamie, that you would confide in me like that, that you would spill your beans.
Oh my God.
Why'd you spill your beans, Jamie?
I was wondering what exactly you were doing.
Why'd you spill your beans? You shouldn't have spilled your beans, Jamie.
Motherfucker.
For anyone who hasn't seen the movie.
What are you doing? Go watch this fucking
just
movie.
Just go watch it. You know what? I'm not even going to explain it. Willem Dafoe's booming voice echoing through a lighthouse.
Why'd you spill your beans?
Why'd you spill your beans?
God, talk about a big performance. Jesus.
So the crazy thing, and then we should get to the pairing terms. But like the crazy thing with the two performances is that Dafoe is going really, really big from the beginning, right? Like the first time he opens his mouth, I think he farts before anybody speaks, but like the first time he opens his mouth, it is this big, broad, ridiculous performance that Eggers described it as a hodgepodge of Captain Ahab, Long John Silver, and the sea captain from The Simpsons, which is undeniable. And he said that like the challenge was like, well, thank God we had somebody like Willem Dafoe who could make that character feel real, who is like this insane cartoon, right?
Right.
And but like Dafoe is going crazy big with all those like fake teeth and the huge beard and the wacky pirate voice. And then once they start getting drunk together and Pattinson's character starts like coming out a little bit more and kind of letting into himself and starts talking a lot, you realize that Pattinson is taking a way bigger and weirder swing with his character than Dafoe.
Yeah, I'm not even sure what was going on with Pattinson.
He's going for
like Boston?
It's like neurotic 19th century like Boston idiot. Like, I don't even know what, but yeah, you just think he's like underplaying it and he's going to let Dafoe chew all the scenery.
And then
once they're drunk and it's like, oh no, this is so big and weird. I love Pattinson going big and weird.
Yep.
Yeah, this is a good movie.
It is.
This is a real good movie. All right. So, James.
My name is Jamie.
So, James.
My name is Jamie.
So, traditionally, when one talks about old school and new school, we say it's when the old school meets new school. But here, it's when old school becomes new school.
Right.
So, what is the old school as regards to Kiyuka? Kiyuka Lake?
Kuka.
Kuka? Like a yep. cucumber?
If the word was literally spelled Q-K-A.
That doesn't help.
Kuka.
That helps less. So what is the old school and how is that becoming the new school as expressed by this year, Finger Lakes, Dry Riesling?
Yes. So I talked a little bit in the beginning about how there's sort of a cohesive voice that's being found in the Finger Lakes. I don't think it has been found yet, but there are a number of producers who are in conversation with one another. Kuka Lake is one of those producers, I think. They're moving towards this style of Riesling that embraces ripeness, but also full dryness and just mouth-watering acidity. I think this started back in the days of Dr. Constantine Frank, which is a winery that's still around.
Wait, that's a winery and not
it's a person who eponymously named the winery, Dr. Constantine Frank Winery.
Did he eponymously name it?
No, the
The winery
is eponymous.
Eponymously named after him.
Yes.
So Dr. Constantine Frank.
Yes.
Who is both a person and a vineyard.
Correct. Dr. Constantine Frank was a Hungarian immigrant at the tail end of the 19th century and was one of the first to, well, it was the first to plant vinifera varieties in the Finger Lakes.
And what are those? What are vinifera varieties?
So Vitis vinifera is the specific scientific name of all of the wine grapes that you know of. The Rieslings and the Cabernet Sauvignons and the Sauvignon Blancs and the Zinfandels and the Shirazes and the Chardonnays, all of them.
And I think that's all the ones that I know of.
That you know more, but that's...
But that sounds like all the grapes.
You've heard of Concord before.
In terms of the juice?
The Concord grape.
Which makes juice.
And also wine.
They make wine from Concord grape juice?
Manischewitz, baby. But also plenty of other brands. And yeah, they make juice, they make jam. The Concord grape is widely grown in America.
And that the botanical scientific name for that is Viniferus concordia?
Vitis labrusca.
Vitis labrusca. That's not as much fun as what I said.
It is not. No, okay. I think that you should be put in charge of the genus and species names.
Now we're fucking talking about something here. Get this Latin bullshit out of here. Let me just make some shit up.
That's what I'm saying.
Treat it just like dinosaurs, where just anybody gets to name it whatever the fuck they want. Most of the dinosaur discoveries are happening in China. And so like all the cool dinosaurs now, they don't sound like fucking Latin bullshit, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, I just read a book about dinosaurs. I'm excited about dinosaurs again.
We love dinosaurs.
Moving on.
Yes, moving on. Concord is Vitis labrusca. There are a number of other varieties that are what we call native varieties. Vitis labrusca is native to the United States. Vitis vinifera is native to, well, really, the Fertile Crescent, the Middle East, and then it traveled to Europe.
And Jamie, how did it travel there?
Colonialism and empire building.
Right. Sprinkle in a crusade here or there, just for good measure.
And a fair bit of genocide.
Right.
So vinifera is thought by many still to be the quote-unquote fine wine grape, or the fine wine species of grapes. There are a number of hybrid varieties. So if you've ever heard me use the term hybrid, it's a crossing of Labrusca or Riparia or whatever other vine variety and vinifera as a way to make it more hardy to the climates of the United States.
I'm with you so far.
Yes. So the Finger Lakes is a really fucking cold region most of the year. It's pretty far north. The winters are very intense. And for a long time, it was basically impossible to, or it was thought to be impossible to keep vinifera varieties alive up there. Turns out that closest to the lakes, because water is a really thermally stable thing, and the lakes are very deep and they don't freeze over often. In fact, Seneca Lake, the centermost one, never freezes because it is so deep that it has a convection current that just keeps everything moving.
Wow.
And there's like a pocket, there's an area around the lake that is warm enough that vines don't die all the time.
Do you mean in the pocket, is it the air temperature or the soil temperature?
The air temperature. I mean, so we'll get into the soil temperature next, because one of the ways to mitigate, aside from being close to the lake, another way to mitigate the freezing temperatures is during the dormant season into the winter, you do what's called hilling up. Basically, packing dirt up against the base of the vine, which has what's called the graft union. That's the most vulnerable point on the plant. And if you protect that with earth, that has a much lower chance of bursting and killing the plant. So between these two things, Dr. Constantine Frank was able to plant a bunch of vineyards and basically kickstart a new era of viticulture in the Finger Lakes. Constantine Frank focused on this sort of dry, precise European style of wine.
And that's the old school.
That's the old school I'm talking about. There is the like older school, which is all native and hybrid grapes.
Right.
Which we probably will talk about another time because I've got thoughts on those grapes.
Thoughts on thoughts.
Thoughts on thoughts on thoughts. But in this context, what I'm talking about is the era of Constantine Frank and then sort of the intervening years which straddle Prohibition, where there was sort of a decline in the industry and then a push towards, once again, native and hybrid varieties because they're easier to farm, more productive, and you can make, you know, sweet whatever that the locals will buy. And now we're coming back to a more precise way of doing things, of both farming and of making wine, and going for this kind of style. you know, it can feel like a completely new and novel way of thinking, but it has happened before. Old school becoming new school.
So again, how does all of that translate? Like, what about this wine that we are drinking? When I'm drinking it, is there anything in it that like is a result of this blending of old school and new school philosophies?
I do mean when old school meets new school in a pretty specifically philosophical way. The specific screeching and textural and expressive, those are the stylistic results of
old school becoming new school.
Becoming new school, yes.
I'll allow it. I'll allow you to keep giving me pairing words that have nothing to do with the thing, the actual thing, the product being paired to.
Motherfucker.
I challenge you in the future, though.
I mean, three of these specifically are talking about the product in the glass.
This time.
And you just lack imagination for the rest of the other things.
Okay, sure. I'm just saying we're talking about the thing and not about the political and economic wine-making forces that shaped the region and the world.
If this podcast abruptly ends at any point, it's because I've killed Scott.
If you hear a wet, hard, metallic sound at any point, it's because I've used an axe to cleave Jamie's head open with a wet, nasty splat.
That was the sound in the movie.
Oh, that sound is unsettling.
Oh, but it's so fucking good. Okay, so when I gave you When Old School Becomes New School, what about this movie brought it into conversation?
So Robert Eggers, the director, is obsessed with the past. He's been a production designer. He's been a researcher. His first feature was set in the 1600s. His second one is set in the late 19th century. His cinematographer described him as not having a widescreen mind, referring specifically to the aspect ratio for this movie. And widescreen is more of a recent invention in cinema. When his brother, Max Eggers, first started working on this project and the script, it was contemporary. And he was like, I wasn't really working. Why don't you take a pass at it? So Robert came in and immediately dragged it back like 150 years in the past. He has this mindset from the past, and that translates into how his movies look and how they're made. So the movie was shot on an archaic aspect ratio of 1.19 to 1.
And for everyone listening, what does that translate to?
It almost looks like a perfect square. It's like almost a box. You're when we did First Cow,
yep,
that was a 1.33:1 aspect ratio, which is like something more akin to like a 4x3 television screen, right? This is even boxier, which means it's more of a square. So horizontally, it's a more narrow image, which also means it's a taller image. It's a throwback. It's what like a lot of the early silence looked like before there was any kind of like industry standard on how films should be presented and therefore how we shoot them. They shot the movie on 35mm, black and white, negative, for some really, really specific reasons, some of which we're going to come to when we talk about texture later. I'm going to quote here the cinematographer, Jaron Blaschke. Most of this is from a really good interview he did with American Cinematographer, which is very technical, but there's some good stuff in there. So what Jaron Blaschke said was, black and white film has a very particular texture. There are three-dimensional chunks of silver embedded in gelatin at different depths and sizes. It's much more physical than even a color film image, which is made of tiny clouds of dye. The chosen film stock that they use for the movie, which is 35mm, what's called double X. The double X had a more local or micro contrast, which emphasizes texture and better differentiates similar tones. They used a cyan filter across the lens, which blocks red light from passing through, to recreate something called the orthochromatic look.
There are a lot of words that you have just used that I don't understand. All
right. Let's wind it back. So what did you not understand?
Okay. So when Jaron Blaschke says that black and white film has a particular texture, how does that translate into something that I can relate to?
Okay. So grain. Grain is the texture that he's talking about. When you see film grain, which is just the little granules and whatever, right? So what he's talking about is that in black and white film, the grain look is achieved through a different chemical process. Because there is texture in it, it creates more texture.
On the screen.
On the literal image that you're capturing.
Okay, got it.
And the double X film stock that they chose, the way he describes it is that it has more local or micro contrast, which means there's more contrast in you get a lot of contrast in a small area of the frame, like a close-up on Pattinson, right? And you just take, like, you look at a part of his cheek. You'll have so much more contrast between the light and the dark areas just in that small sample.
I see.
So you get a lot of very specific contrast detail that translates as texture.
Okay, got it. And then orthochromatic.
Film in the 19th century was not able to capture red. The color red was just not represented. Film until like 1870 was only able to capture blue. And then by 1870, they were able to capture greens in it. But red didn't come until much later. What that does, the orthochromatic look, is it changes in particular skin tones. So what Blaschke said is that skin tones would still record rather darkly and clouds would not separate strongly against a blue sky. Variations in red-orange tones were exaggerated, so blemishes and textures on a face were emphasized. This look not only evokes a bygone time, but further weathers the appearance of our salty, beaten-down characters in the lighthouse. But they're using this filter and this film stock to try and replicate the look of 150 years ago in film shooting to make it period accurate for the movie, but also to create these particular aesthetics that they want, the texture and the grit and the grain and all the detail in the skin tones. They also shot on really, really old lenses. Blaschke went to Panavision and asked them what weird vintage lenses they had, quote, off the menu.
Love that.
And they ended up selecting these vintage Baltar lenses, which were designed in the 30s. The ones that were used in the movie were dated to 1941 and 1944. They pass a lot of blue and ultraviolet light, which is great for the orthochromatic look. Blaschke says, I found them to be the most glowing, beautiful portrait lenses I'd ever seen, stopping short of getting too soft or flary. Their most beautiful feature is how highlights glow and shimmer. Their smoothing character could balance out the micro contrast of the double X and the orthochromatic filter. All of this stuff adds up to, like, they have a look that they want to achieve, but they're using all of these old school tools, old lenses, and like archaic aspect ratios and specific film stocks to replicate the way things used to look before film had really evolved to a certain point. The problem here, and this is for anybody who's shooting on 35 millimeter now, which is a small handful of filmmakers, the problem with in the movie world of old school becoming new school is that the new school has taken over the industry and has completely abandoned the old school.
Right.
Do you know what dailies are?
Yes.
Can you explain to the audience what dailies are?
Probably not as well as you can, but I'll take a swing at it.
Let's go.
Dailies are a daily recap of what was shot that day.
Or the previous day's footage, essentially.
Right.
And it's like a rough assembly that the editor put together and the director and some of the key personnel get to like watch their key shots. So dailies are super important for a couple of things. One, it helps the director know if they got the shots or not. And on a film production, you might be tearing a set down like the day after you're finished shooting it. So sometimes you need a daily just to be able to say, all right, we didn't get this. We have to go back and we have to shoot it before the scene is shot. Dailies, when you see something big in a screening room up on a big screen, is how you check, at least in the old school days, how you would check focus, how you would check exposure. For this movie.
Oh, God.
They didn't see dailies until a week after shooting.
Because of processing the film.
Because of how few processing labs are left open. They shot this movie in Nova Scotia, and dailies were shipped to Burbank every single day. Processed in Burbank and then sent back. And so about a week after they would shoot a scene, they would then have digital compressed dailies. They weren't getting the film print sent back to them. They were getting a DI or a digital intermediary made up and sent back to them. And then if they wanted to watch something at like approximating something like 4K resolution, they'd have to wait a few more days to get an even higher res file to come back to them.
Wow.
The other thing about the way that they decided to shoot this movie is light. So black and white film stock, especially black and white negative film stock, is what's called a slower speed film. So speed in film is how quickly the film reacts to the exposure of light. And so if it's a slow speed film, to properly get an exposure volume, all of their lights are about 1,000,000% brighter on set than they appear on screen. In a scene where it's, and there's a lot of them, where it's just Defoe and Pattinson sitting at a table and they have like a little kerosene right. lamp in between them. Everybody had to wear sunglasses on set because of like the crazy bright bulbs yep. that they would put in these practical fixtures or in the other lights that they would put around there just to get an image that in the film is extremely dark.
So your take on old school becomes new school is that it can be a problem and was very significantly for this production.
That's not my take. I'm just describing the problems that come with it. This is a contemporary filmmaker with a contemporary point of view who is looking to the past and looking to the tools of the past to tell this particular story, which is like, in a way, it's the story is very rooted in apparently like traditional and like nautical stories. They reference Melville a lot and another writer who was a chronicler of like the nautical vernacular of seamen.
Right.
Guys, for the first time ever in his life, Jamie has not snickered when someone said seaman in reference to a sailor.
I snickered internally.
Okay, I didn't see it.
I don't have much more to say about old school becoming new school. I have been thinking about it and failing to come up with anything. I'm creatively bereft.
Wow. Jamie, you're fucking...
I'm disappointing. I know.
It's not just that you're disappointing. It's that this is like... I mean, it's... I'm just...
I don't even know what we're doing here.
Jamie.
Yes.
I'm sick of your laugh. I'm sick of your snoring and your goddamn farts. Your goddamn farts. Goddamn your farts. Jamie, you smell like piss. You smell like jizz. You smell like rotten dick, like curdled foreskin, like hot onions fucked a farmyard shit house. And I'm sick of your smell. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of it, you goddamn drunk. You goddamn no account drunken son of a bitch bastard liar. That's what you are. You're a goddamn drunken horse shitting short shit liar. A liar.
I gotta say, that was a good reading. That was good.
Well, I felt every word of it.
But also the hot onions bit.
There's so many good lines in this movie. All of Defoe's insane monologues about Poseidon's trident and all of that crazy shit like is wild. And then Pattinson just cuts loose with this string of beautiful expletives. It's just magnificent.
What was it? Hot onions fucked a...
You smell like hot onions fucked a farmyard shithouse.
I'm going to say that at the next wine tasting I'm at.
I'm getting notes of hot onions that may have been fucked by a farmyard shithouse.
This wine screeches.
How does it screech? How does the wine screech?
I'm talking specifically about the acid profile of the wine.
Okay.
So we can say, obviously, that this is a high acid wine. You can do the drool test. You'll drool in your lap. It's a high acid wine. Scott is right now checking if he's going to drool. He's waiting for it. Got a big old drool running down his chin all the way to his lap.
I'm just going to spit on your floor.
You threatened to do that earlier. It's very rude.
You went to the bathroom. You don't know I didn't do it.
That's
true.
You
went to the bathroom 4 times last time.
I need to clean these floors now.
Your acidity level. I would say medium plus. Do you think it's high? It's high acidity?
I think it's high. It really announces itself. And acid also notably is a flavor enhancer, which adds to the later note that I have on expressive. Everything about this wine gets turned up to 12 by the acidity. It makes it louder. It makes it impossible to ignore.
How?
It takes over your whole mouth hole.
Because of the acid.
Because of the acid. It calls your attention to everything that's going on in your mouth. You're looking at me like you don't agree or you don't understand.
Look, I don't need like the chemical or like biological process to explain what you're talking about, because I wouldn't understand that anyway.
Right.
But I don't know. How does it draw attention to the other things? Like, all right, so it enhances everything in the wine. How does the acid amplify the sugar?
The acid and the sugar are two different things that balance each other out. The acid amplifies the flavors.
Okay. How does it amplify fruit flavors?
I honestly don't know chemically. I just know that it does.
How in your mouth describe the amplification that's happening? I just don't understand. This is another thing, like where if you explain it to me and I can process it in my brain,
right.
I think I can identify it in my mouth.
I think this might come down to tasting experience in some ways, because I have tasted wines that are lower in acidity that have a very similar flavor profile, and then tasted wines with acidity like this that really kind of jumps out at you and everything feels more intense. Everything is bigger, louder, more intense because of the acidity. And to bring it to like cocktail making.
Okay.
I've, you know, in designing cocktails, I've used acidity as a flavor enhancer before. Take the daiquiri, your classic daiquiri, which is rum with simple syrup and lime juice. The lime juice is less neutral than lemon juice, but the acidity of it makes whatever rum you're using pop.
Pop, pop.
Pop, pop. It brings those flavors a little bit more forward, particularly in my experience, like a barrel-aged rum. The caramel, toffee, butterscotch notes get even more amplified by it. Acidity also gives me the sort of illusion of speed down the palate. I've said, I'm sure you've heard, like racy acidity.
No.
I've said it.
I have not heard it. Racy like fast or racy like risque?
Racy like fast. The velocity, if you choose to think of it that way, of flavors playing across your tongue can, for me, be increased by acidity. Another example is in cooking. Take any dish, add acid to it, and it tastes more like itself.
Okay, give me an example. Because I'm allowing the premise.
The simplest example here is like sauteed broccoli. Like you put broccoli in a pan with some oil, get maybe a little bit of a char on it, add your salt, maybe black pepper, just a simple way to do broccoli.
Right.
Now add lemon and everything is more vibrant. Everything is more, is heightened.
The broccoli flavors.
Yes.
But does it not also taste like lemon now?
Well, it also tastes like lemon, but lemon is a more neutral acid. Like if you really want to do like the simplest way, you know, get white vinegar and add it, but that doesn't taste as good as lemon does.
Is this why we do lemon on fish?
You do lemon on fish to make everything more vibrant.
To make it taste more like fish.
Yes.
You said to make everything taste more like itself.
Yes.
All right.
That is correct.
All right.
When I get a really high acid wine that also has this ripe character to it, this like very expressive fruit and floral component, the acidity brings the volume up really high. And to me that it feels screeching.
All right. I intellectually understand what you're talking about. I cannot experientially vouch for you, but I'm going to allow this to roll for a little bit.
Okay.
And listeners at home, if you guys have any issue with what Jamie just said, you just slide into his DMs.
Please.
And you just let him know what's going on.
Yeah.
Tell him how it is.
Shout at me.
Yeah.
So when I use the word screeching, I think there's an obvious answer, and then there is a much more deep answer to what about this movie is screeching. Obviously, the mermaid is screeching.
She makes a little bit of screechy noises. She makes some pretty amazing.
She screeches.
Screechy noises. That's a big obvious one. I really, though, I wasn't even thinking about the mermaid when I picked screeching. I was just thinking about, I think I used screeching kind of as a catch-all for grating sound.
The foghorn?
Well, the fucking foghorn that you get right up in the beginning. The foghorn that sounds like score. It sounds like score in the first few minutes so much that there's the part where the two wikis come into the lighthouse and then the foghorn goes off while they're inside and Pattinson reacts to it, which was the first time that I realized that this wasn't like an atonal score opening the movies, that that's actually like sound effect, that that's sound design. I think the movie itself aesthetically is often grating, like intentionally, even when it's being beautiful, but the score just bludgeons you with the dread and the discomfort and the atonality.
It's a lot.
So the composer, Mark Corvin, so he used a lot of brass and in a traditional orchestra for the score. But also, as he told Filmmaker magazine, there was quite a bit of experimentation. So he experimented with instruments like a glass harmonica.
Okay.
And friction mallets dragged across wood, glass, and cymbals.
Cool.
And then, this is quoting the Filmmaker magazine piece, there was Corvin's own apprehension engine.
Jesus Christ.
A homemade electroacoustic device, which is literally rulers, coils, magnets, and guitar necks arranged with pickups on a set of wooden boards that the composer commissioned a friend of his to build for him. We have a link to an improvisation that Corvin did using the apprehension engine. We'll have to share it with people.
It will be shared on the social media. Yeah. That's so cool.
It's a very bizarre and unpleasant sounding instrument.
Sure is.
Yeah. He has said that the apprehension engine is not music, but it's meant to like sonically evoke sound. Or sonically evoke emotion.
Sonically invoke sound.
Here's another Kubrick reference. The score at times reminds me of the score to The Shining. In particular, think about like whenever, like in the back half when Jack is going crazy and the drums and the percussion and some of the high strings, like the atonality of it and where it's meant to create atmosphere and dread and a visceral response, but not an emotional or narrative response.
Right.
And something else I learned is that the score and the sound design, so when we talk about, so score is the music and sound design is everything else, right?
Right.
Like sound design is how dialogue is recorded and processed and mixed and all of the sound effects and all of the ambience and then the general mix overall. There ended up being a lot of interplay when they got mixed together. And at times it's hard to separate. So like the whole opening, like 5 minute sequence of the two of them slowly approaching the island on the barge and then getting into the lighthouse up until like their first dialogue, it sounds like there's a ton of like ominous music playing over that.
Right.
All sound design.
All sound design. Yeah.
The foghorn I thought was music. The foghorn is sound effect. There are things that you think are sound effects in the movie that are created by the composer, like this total blurring of it. But it not only is it unsettling, but just oftentimes the sounds that they achieved are just very unpleasant and very difficult on the ears.
Yeah, that's true. While we were talking about the me describing the wine and its acidity as screeching, a thing that I forgot to mention, which you're touching on, which is the how it can be a little bit unpleasant. Like you're talking about this, the sound design being grating and difficult and loud, right? Like high acid to the point where it's almost a little bit too much. If you're not having, let's say, food with it, it's a lot to deal with. Did you have food while you were drinking this wine with the movie?
No, because I have yet to be given a food pairing recommendation to go along with the wine. So no, I did not have any food.
Did you find that you were like puckering a little bit too much, or you found the acid to be a little bit unpleasant?
I thought it was medium plus acidity. I didn't find it to be overly acidic.
Huh.
Definite acid there, but I didn't think it was too much.
The point being that like if you had, let's say, a bag of Doritos, of Cool Ranch Doritos with this wine, that screeching acidity might be tamed a little bit.
By Cool Ranch Doritos? This is your snack pairing recommendation?
This is a quick snack pairing. If you need a little something to munch on while you're watching this movie and drinking this wine, Cool Ranch Doritos.
Cool Ranch Doritos. And this is a special shout out to friends of the show, the Hafingtons, who requested movie snack pairings to go with the wines. And so, guys, if you were looking for something boutique and farm to table and super fancy foodie treats to with truffle oil and creme fraiche and whatever to go along, nope, you ain't getting fancy truffle bacon popcorn. You get Cool Ranch Doritos.
Fucking Cool Ranch Doritos.
This is what Jamie's bringing to the table, y'all.
He's making fun of me, but I stand by what I said.
I mean, I like Cool Ranch Doritos.
Yeah, everybody does because they're delicious.
But you think that they would go with this wine?
Oh, absolutely.
Do you have any Cool Ranch Doritos?
In the house, no.
Then what the fuck good are you to either of us?
Clearly, I'm not good for either of us. You got more on the screeching?
On the screeching? Do you have anything more on my screeching? Because you were just like, oh, while you were talking, I thought of something that I was interested in.
Right, for sure. I mean, I'm very self-centered. I want to talk about me.
I'm aware. But we're here for them, for the listener.
Sometimes I need to be reminded. I appreciate you being here for me to remind me about them.
I'm not here for you. Let's be very clear. I'm here for them.
I don't have much other than I agree with you. Like it's the sound design and the score are grating. And if you have the volume up to what an appropriate level, which is loud.
Which is loud and unpleasant.
Right.
If the foghorn does not rattle you a little bit, it's not loud enough.
Correct. And I certainly did. And I was worried that my neighbors would get upset.
Your TV speakers aren't that loud. You're okay.
But it's, you know, it's a South Philly row house. People are close.
Yeah, that's true.
People are very close.
Jamie, top 5 most unpleasant sound effects in this movie.
Oh my God. Well,
go.
So the mermaid.
I found her tones to be soothing, but okay.
Then
no,
clearly
no, she makes a terrible, like, yeah, dolphin screeching noise.
Oh God, it's fucking awful. It's horrendous. Wonderful. So the mermaid, then the foghorn, then the horrible squelching noise when
of the seagull being massacred.
So that's the next one.
Okay.
So the squelching noise of the axe coming down on Defoe. And yeah. Then the squelching noise of Arpad's beating the fucking seagull to death.
Which this is not going to be popular with very many people. I think that scene is hilarious.
And I agree.
It's funny. At first, it's not funny when he's just killing a seagull. And then when he's continuing to like
thwap this dead, broken body against the rock,
it just gets funnier. And I will not apologize. Also, that seagull had it coming.
Yeah, the seagull is being antagonistic.
The implication is very strong. That the reason that there are dead and bloodied seagulls polluting their clean water in the cistern is because the evil one-eyed seagull murdered them and pushed them in there.
Right.
This seagull was asking for it.
Victory lap.
Right. Well, and then he attacks him.
Right.
Yeah, fuck that seagull.
As a lover of birds, generally, it's hard to say, fuck that seagull, but that seagull was being a dick.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
You've done four.
So I've done four.
Do you have a fifth? Because there's an obvious fifth, but you go ahead.
The fifth, and I don't know if this is the obvious one, but it's the distorted screaming when Arpats looks into the lantern.
Oh, see, that's a kind of a nice sound.
That is not a nice sound. What kind of insane person are you?
I'm just thinking of the sound of the lamp house, which is like soothing and reverberant. What is the distorted scream that he makes when he looks into it?
He's screaming and it's heavily distorted.
When he's opened it up and then the light. Oh yeah, that sound is insane.
It's horrifying.
Yeah. Well, then one of the other sounds has to come off, because clearly the top five has to include the sound of Arpat's jacking it.
Ooh, yeah.
No, that, I mean, that's just a regular jacking it sound. That's fine.
And yeah, it's just like hand on flesh.
Yeah, wet jacking it sounds.
For the listener, we're both kind of, we're making faces like cats that just smelled something bad.
I think for some people, the sound of Arpat's jacking it is probably a very appealing prospect.
A very small subset of people.
Probably larger than you think. Moving from the screech into the texture.
Yes.
Are we about to talk about mouthfeel?
We are about to talk about mouthfeel.
The textural qualities of this wine.
How the wine feels in your mouth.
But not how it fills your mouth.
Not how it fills your mouth, no.
This is not a mouth-filling wine.
No. Very technically, the mouthfeel of a wine can be influenced by a number of things, including phenolic compounds, tannin, glycerol, sugar, alcohol as well.
Wetness. Can't tell me that the moisture isn't part of the mouthfeel.
Sure. Wetness.
Okay,
the
great.
The wetness of the wine contributes to the mouthfeel.
This is a wet wine. It is actually a dry wine.
It's a totally dry wine. It says dry on the label.
Because it's not sweet, but it is wet.
That's right.
Okay.
So the texture of this wine for me is a little rocky. I'm like wading into uncomfortable territory because we're talking about minerality and it's kind of a hot button issue in wine. Lots of people think that when Psalms talk about minerality or the tastes and flavors of rocks, and we've talked about them on this podcast before, that we're talking about like literal uptake of minerals into the plant translated to the grapes and to our mouths.
That's what terroir is, right?
It's
how the root pulls the raw earthy elements into the wine.
I'm making a little joke. As a baby psalm, that honestly it was my conception of this.
That's embarrassing. Yeah, jeez, Jamie. Even I know better than that.
Thank you, Scott.
And I just described this wine as wet.
Fuck you, buddy. That doesn't mean, I don't think, that rocks and minerals aren't important flavor notes to talk about when we're talking about wine.
Just that some people think it's a hot button issue.
Well, some people think that it's a literal translation of minerals into the wine. The chemical reality is not entirely understood. However, when I put my nose in this glass, I smell wet slate and dusty granite. And when I put this wine in my mouth and I swish it around, I feel a texture of like rough mountain rocks. And whatever the chemical explanation for those things is, it's a sensation that I experience. This wine feels a little rough and gritty. And I think it's because this wine probably sees a couple of hours of skin contact after pressing. So it gets a little bit of the tannin from the grape skins. Also, Riesling has a significant phenolic character to it, meaning it has those chemicals present in the grapes. So it gives you sort of an astringent feel on your tongue. This doesn't have a silky texture to it the way, let's say, the Bonnie Doon. I know you didn't like it, but it did. It had, for lack of a better word, a smoothness to its feel in your mouth.
This has some grit.
When I drink this wine, there's sort of a push-pull between that grip and that texture, the rough mountain rocks, as I've described it, and the acidity. And together, those things give me a sort of tension. I used this word when we were talking about Parasite and Fabrice Gasnier.
Tension. Between two things.
Between two things. There's that push-pull. It's like a tightening rubber band. There's like a...
I understand what tension is. Not entirely in the context of wine, but
it's filled with nervous energy. I'm trying to explain it a little bit more for you and for our viewers, listeners, whatever they are.
I'm just saying the word tension.
You understand it. Some other people might not.
What tension means?
Yes.
But you think they're okay with phenolic compounds?
Stop it. Anyway, that for me is a very important part of this wine. It's an important part of the broader conversation in the Finger Lakes about making wines that have this kind of presence that present like European wines of a similar quality, and that also are built to age and pair well with food.
I want to rewind back a second.
Yes.
You said that minerality is a hot button issue in the wine world right now. Mm-hmm. Because there are some people who are mad at the idea, or they're up in arms about the idea of minerality misrepresenting and somehow saying that minerality means if I taste rocks, it means that those rocks are in the soil.
Correct.
Do any of those people get mad when you detect notes of strawberry in a wine as though that somehow implies that there are strawberries grown nearby?
They don't, no.
So how can you hold these two ideas in your head at the same time?
It's baffling.
All right.
So that's my case for textural. I think it's an essential part of what this wine is, what makes it compelling to me, why I like it, and why I chose it. Why did you choose this movie based on that word?
Well, just like look at it. Just look at all the texture on screen in the movie.
Yes.
Like it is just loaded with tangible textural details all over the place from the beginning. From the production design, the set dressing, the weather, the real weather, the weather effects that are created when they're on set, the wardrobe, how their skin looks. So like this is a big part of that orthochromatic look that we talked about, which is that because red light does not pass through or does not get represented in orthochromatic photography, what that does is that the skin tones are much darker. Like for two white men, Pattinson and Defoe have much darker gray skin tones in this black and white movie than you might anticipate. Not just that the tone is darker, but if you look at any close up on their faces, there's so much detail and texture that you would never see in just a plain color shot of the two of them. You can see all of the like subtle, again, like local contrast in pigmentation. There's this otherworldly character to their skin, but it also shows every blemish and every bit of weathering. It's like you can reach out and touch anything that's on screen.
I have a question. It doesn't seem intuitive to talk about colored light when you're talking about black and white film.
Whether or not the final film product, and when I say film, I mean like the actual like emulsion that runs through the camera.
Right.
Whether or not that film can express color, the light that's hitting it is still colored light. We talk about the three primary colors in like visual in photography is red, blue, green. Every bit of light that is hitting the film can be broken down into a red component, a green component, and a blue component, whether or not the film is able to process that. So if the film does not react to the red light, which in original like 19th century photography was just because it was chemically unable to react to that red light and therefore red was not represented, or with this movie where they use a filter to block out the red light, either way, anything that is the color red is still not going to be expressed in the movie. So even in a grayscale image, the skin tones that would be largely represented by red tones and then augmented by bits of green and bits of blue are only being expressed by the other two colors and not by the red. So it's coming up as a darker image. The red is going to be more of the brightness into the image or into a face, into a close-up like that.
Okay. That makes sense. Thank you for that.
Yeah. They talked a lot about whether or not they could shoot it digitally and try to achieve a black and white look. The DP, Blaschke, was saying that one of their producers straight up asked him, like, are you seriously telling me that there is no way to achieve the look that you want, this specific black and white look that you want digitally? And his answer was, no, there was no way to do it. They ultimately went out and like ran tests to see if you could shoot it either on color film and then through a digital intermediary, strip it down to a black and white element that could replicate this look of like late 19th century photography. And they did a digital, just a straight like digital black and white image. And there was nothing that could match. So they put in all the extra fucking work to do it. But then it pans out in like those crazy inky pools of like shadow and the blood. Oh, that disgusting. The blood that looks like tar, like it when it splatters out of people or exploded birds.
Also, even the whitewash when they're whitewashing the lighthouse.
Yeah. Which has the best scare in the whole movie, I think.
Best scare? You mean like him falling?
Him falling terrified me.
Huh.
I'm afraid of heights to begin with, but like he's hanging down. He gets dropped basically like twice. Like, I'm going to lower you down. Why just spill your beans? And like lowers him, but like two.
He didn't
like,
say that in the
why
scene.
Why just spill your beans,
Scott,
Jamie?
Just really loves that. He texted me the night after he knew I was watching this movie.
I texted you while I thought you were watching it. And apparently you hadn't finished it at that point.
I had not. No. Yeah. Why'd you spill your beans?
Why'd you spill your beans?
I didn't spill my beans, Scott.
I don't know. We're going to see what beans got spilled on the recording. Anyway, there's texture. There's a lot of palpable texture.
I concur.
again, quoting cinematographer Jaron Blaschke, this time he was talking to IndieWire. He described his director saying that Rob Eggers loves texture. He wants the set to have water stains and filth. In both movies, meaning The Lighthouse and their first collaboration, The Witch, he's had the entire floor redone.
Jesus Christ.
How often do you see the floor in a movie? I will tell you, it's not terribly often. But he wanted it to look dirty and gritty and lived in and feel real, which is very strange for a movie that is utterly removed from reality.
Completely not at all a real thing.
What's weird is that Eggers has this obsession with like texture and detail and this creating this like very real place for you on screen. And then he makes these movies that are expressionistic, like they're not naturalistic. It there's a contrast, right? There's this tension between.
You're using a lot of words that are tying in here.
But there's a tension between like the production design and the detail and the reality that's created, and then the detached from reality of the movie, which I think this takes us into the next thing. I think it's expressive or expressionistic, but let me back up. So the wine is expressive?
The wine is expressive.
Is it because of the acid that helps it express itself more?
Partly. So expressive is one of those words that wine people use when they don't know what to say. It's one of those words, and I didn't really want to use it because it's that. However, it's really relevant to this wine, to this category, by which I mean Finger Lakes Riesling. This wine has a lot of the characteristics that I'd associate with an austere or a neutral wine, like Chablis or Muscadet, the wines that are that classically pair with like oysters and light seafood dishes, stuff that is high acid and mineral driven. This wine is specifically not neutral. It is high acid. There is a giant mineral character to it, but it's very aromatic, and the flavors and aromas are an essential part of what it is. I've said the word ripe a lot this episode, and I mean that literally. The grapes on the vine get very ripe, and then I mean that also as it pertains to the fruit character. Very ripe Valencia orange bordering on grapefruit, which I know you hate.
That is correct. Grapefruit is the worst.
Grapefruit gang, always.
Is there anybody on board Grapefruit Gang with Jamie? Like officially, since I've started my beef with grapefruit on the podcast. Because so far I've got one person on my side against grapefruit. Do you have anybody who's with you?
I mean, everybody likes grapefruit.
Officially. Has anyone texted you to be like, hey, I'm on your side about grapefruit?
Someone has, but I can't remember who.
No, that's not true. No, if you someone can't remember, definitely it didn't has.
Someone,
didn't happen.
I might have been Wendy, actually.
Betrayal. Son of a bitch. Grapefruit!
Love grapefruit. It's so good. It's so yummy. But this also has like a ripe peach and nectarine kind of flavor to it. And like I said, sort of a like a hibiscus elderflower character. There's a lot of flavor here. There's a lot of mineral. There's a lot of fruit. There's a lot of flower that it kind of jumps out of the glass. And when you take it to the palate, it's not shy about its flavors. That's what I mean by expressive. And this is all due to, well, not all of it, but in huge part, the extra sunshine hours that the Finger Lakes growing region affords. And then also just the reflection of sun off of the lake back onto the grapes gives them even more of an ability to ripen and develop these flavors. So it's tied to the place that they're grown as well. And in times past, some people would harvest a little bit earlier to sort of lean away from that kind of
expression.
Yes. And also too, because people were afraid of the fungal pressure that exists in the Finger Lakes.
Fungal pressure.
Well
pressing
said.
Down on me. Oh, I think we're going to get sued now.
That's bad.
I don't want to fuck with this anymore.
We're definitely not getting sued. Parodies are fair game. You're true. I am true. So for anyone listening who doesn't know what, thank you, Scott.
Wait, this isn't parody anymore. I'm just doing this.
Now you're just doing the song. Yep. Just a quick, because I threw that term out there and I'm sure there are some people who don't know what I mean. It's a very humid area of the world, the northeast of the United States. And in the late season, one of the things that farmers and winemakers are afraid of happening before the grapes are harvested is for fungus or rot to develop on the grapes and ruin the wine.
And that's bad.
That is bad.
Ruining the wine is bad.
So if you harvest earlier, it's an easy way to protect yourself from that, but you're robbing yourself of the extra ripeness that you could get.
Harvesting earlier protects us from fungal pressure. Great.
Moving along, what about this movie?
Stop asking me these questions, Jamie. Just look at the movie. Look at the movie.
Listen, we're doing a podcast for the listeners. Fine.
As I said, it is expressive to the point of being expressionistic. Do I need to define expressionism?
It would be helpful.
Like it would be helpful. Yeah. Okay.
I was going to ask.
All right. So I pulled this from Tate, the British art museums. Expressionism refers to art in which the image of reality is distorted in order to make it expressive of the artist's inner feelings or ideas. That is this movie. Think about the subjective camera and sound, the way things are distorted and exaggerated visually and auditorily. Think about the super stark black and white photography. Black and white photography is itself now, like, as a stylistic choice, now that we can more realistically capture the world around us with color, now to use black and white is in itself, it's a creative and I think it's an expressionistic decision.
I grant the premise for this movie specifically.
Sure. The performances, the enormous performances, the gigantic, towering, absurd performances.
So all seafaring people in the 19th century didn't behave like Willem Dafoe?
I mean, I think some of them behaved like our pets.
Okay.
But the enormous, like, non-naturalistic, very theatrical performances, the heightened period accurate dialogue, that you could think of as something more naturalistic, except that it comes out in these, like, towering theatrical monologues, like a monologue or a soliloquy itself, like that. Not all of the things that I'm describing are on their own would be expressionistic, but putting all of them together and you have something that, like, heightens this movie to a whole nother place that is suggestive more than it is literal. Think about the enveloping, that hypnotic light of the actual lamp house. Once you get up there, it looks like he's bathing in the light, right? And then the way the light somehow even makes a sound, it's so removed from reality to suggest something. The dreams themselves are, because they're dreams, can be surrealist or they can be expressionistic. But the movie has dream logic editing throughout, like where you'll have something end and then we just cut and we're into another place. And did I just wake up? Did I fall asleep there? Like,
I was really interested by the moments where we're shown a thing followed by an argument between Arpatz and Dafoe, where Dafoe says an opposite thing had just happened.
Opposite. Yeah.
And you're left wondering, like, what in their world actually happened?
Yeah, like when Pattinson is about to get in, like, the little life raft boat, essentially, and, like, paddle his ass back out to shore because they've been stranded together for so long. And Dafoe shows up with an axe and chops the whole thing to fucking pieces. And then they're back at the lighthouse. And then Pattinson says, why would you do that? Why were you so crazy? And he's, well, actually, Arpatz, I have forgotten both of the characters' names, which is weird. They're both named Tom. Spoilers, they're both named Tom.
Well, I mean, Arpatz is Ephraim.
Right. Ephraim and Thomas.
Ephraim Winslow and Thomas. Anyway, but then he confesses that he's actually Tom Hardy?
It's not Tom Hardy.
It's not Tom Hardy. As I was saying that, I was like, that's wrong.
I don't have a Bane voice.
That was a bad one.
It's just like a dog to me. but yeah, and then they're back at the house and Dafoe, like you're saying, Dafoe says, you were the one who went out and chopped up the boat. Like, right. Yeah, there's a bunch of moments like that. And you're never given any grounding in reality. We never have the moment where it comes back and, like, this is what really happened in that moment. Like, No, you're just lost in a fever dream.
Yep. And then the, like, horrifying distorted scream when the lantern opens and you're like, you know that you're not going to see what's in the lantern, but you really want to.
You really want to. And then your little coda on the end of that is your Prometheus.
That image.
It's so upsetting.
Is indelible so upsetting. in my brain.
Is it really?
Well, because I find the Prometheus myth to be really compelling and kind of horrifying, the idea of, like, being chained to a rock and having a bird eat your liver every fucking day.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
We've interacted with birds before. We know what, like, at least I've been bitten by birds before. I've worked in pet stores. The idea of having one eat me alive is kind of horrifying. Beaks are scary.
And they're very sharp.
Super sharp.
Not clean.
I'm much less concerned with the cleanliness than I am with the, like, immediate, like, rending of flesh.
What if you get infected?
not a problem for Prometheus the Titan.
But it might be a problem for dirty, gritty, piss-smelling our pets.
Yeah. So it is expressionistic, and expressionistic is to be expressive.
To be expressive to an extreme degree. To be expressive, and the point is to create something that is removed from just representational art, right? Like not just recreating the real world, but creating something heightened and different to make an artistic statement. Don't ask me what the fucking artistic statement of the movie is.
Like, I was about to.
No, because there are some movies where I am happy to like break down what I think like the thematic underpinnings are. And then there's going to be other movies where I'm like, hey, I apparently need to read like several pieces of like great literature about the nautical world to even understand like a baseline of what the literary thematic references are.
Right.
But also like there are some movies like this one is so in my sweet spot of like aesthetically what I get so excited by that like I will need to watch it probably a couple more times.
Where are you, Scott Hudson, left after watching this movie? Like where's your head at?
I'm just delighted by it. I cackled throughout when I watched it a few nights ago. I think it's funny. I think the stuff that's dark and fucked up tickles me in a way that like my response is to laugh because it's so repulsive and so shocking. And because the characters are so big and so broad, how can you get too upset and take anything too seriously that has the fucking sea captain from The Simpsons as a main character? Like, for as much as I can invest in like emotionally, like their toxic relationship and how the two of them can't get along, they're both just going so big and so broad and swinging for the fences that I have to laugh. It's such a rarefied experience to see something that is this provocative and also this entertaining. It's repulsive, but it's entertaining. It's funny. There's songs, there's dances, there's thrills, there's scares.
I agree. I think that a lot of people will not like this movie. This is a polarizing, I'm sure.
It is off-putting to human beings. Yes.
I didn't have the strong delight that you had at the end of this movie. I very much enjoyed it. I was left a little shaken and horrified, but also excited by it being something so new and so unique.
Yeah.
Just the one thing you said about how can you take it seriously with like performances this broad? I was still taking it, I think, a little bit too seriously up until, I don't know, the hour and a half mark, because they spend the first 45 minutes being serious, even with these broad, these really broad characters.
Jamie, what are you talking about? 5 minutes into the movie, you get your first of many percussive pointed farts from Defoe.
Okay.
That undercuts aside, so much of the tension.
It does, but you're still like following, I don't know, the eyes of the audience, or at least my eyes were on Pattinson more than they were on Defoe as the point of view character, and trying to figure out where he's from, what he's doing, and like how he's going to deal with this domineering presence of Defoe. I'm not trying to say that you're wrong, because obviously I lean more to your way of thinking, but I can definitely empathize with the people who will find this off-putting and will miss the part that these are characters not to be taken seriously.
Well, so I should clarify. It's not that I don't think you should take the movie or take them seriously. A lot of people just put this, pigeonholed it, and said it's a horror movie. And I think that's such a narrow look at this movie.
Yeah.
Like the director refused to categorize it in a genre. Like,
is it a member of a genre? Could it possibly be?
Not really. I mean, like the closest thing to it is the early German 1920s expressionist, like F.W. Murnau. Like one of the most famous examples would be Murnau's Nosferatu, or the famous Cabinet of Dr. Cagliari, which are these like iconic and extremely influential German silent films, which have beautiful use of like high contrast and shadows and very distorted and angular and weird set design and backdrops. And this movie has a lot of that stuff in its DNA. But that's not really a genre. Like, you know, a genre is a set of like narrative or aesthetic tropes that you're working in, right? Like German silent expressionism is kind of a label that got put on something like after the fact.
So I have a question for you.
Yes.
You're doing a second movie after this movie. What's your double feature?
A double feature? well, look, if you like this movie and you can roll with it, then I have something that is possibly even more bizarro and off-putting and maybe further outside of your comfort zone. 2013, this is from writer-director Ben Wheatley, and it's called A Field in England. So this is also a black and white period piece. It's set in England during the 17th century Civil War, and there's a handful of deserters who flee the battlefield, and they end up hiding all together in this like open field. And when they're scrounging for food, they grab a big old fistful of mushrooms, and they spend the back half of the movie tripping balls.
Yep. Okay.
It is awesome and weird, and like a lot of Ben Wheatley's movies, I don't think it entirely works, but like the stuff that does work really fucking works, and it's wild and totally unforgettable. If you were down with this movie, I have another oddball, surrealist, impressionistic black and white period piece, which is Ben Wheatley's A Field in England.
A Field in England.
So James.
Yes.
Let's say I enjoy this wine.
Yes.
Dealer's choice. I'm at the bar. Hey, barkeep, this glass of grape juice was pretty tasty. What else you got?
Okay. You want to move on to something stylistically similar, but from a totally other area. I would say go for wines from a producer called Rocher de Violette. It's a winemaker named Xavier Weisskopf that makes really killer Chenin Blancs in the Loire Valley. He does a number of single vineyard expressions, but also just the base Chenin, which is not very expensive. It's fucking killer. And that leans even more into this sort of like fruity floral zone, and then like goes even farther and is like green and jasmine tea almost. I've always liked the idea of a citywide of, you know, a beer and a shot, or in this case, a wine and
a smaller glass of wine.
I would make yourself like a little mini martini on the side of this glass of wine.
A little mini martini.
Yeah. Mini martini.
A little cute,
mini,
tiny baby martini.
Yeah.
Gin, teeny.
Vermouth, twist of lemon next to this Riesling. Sounds great. It's time for wife takes.
We need to do them. So this is the latest iteration of our new game. My delightful wife, Tani, is through this game recreating her favorite pastime of going to a restaurant where Jamie worked, ordering some wine, and then throwing some extremely pretentious and flowery descriptions of that wine back at him to, you know, totally undermine everything about his profession that he's dedicated his life to.
She's a lovely person.
She's really good. But so this little game here is, she's doing it again. It's a few takes and a lie. She's changing fucking every time here. So I have a few floral descriptions of this wine from Tani. I will read them to you. And Jamie, in each category, you will have to guess the one that has no grounding in reality whatsoever.
Got it.
All right. So first up, which of the following 19th century naval drinks does this wine least resemble?
Jesus Christ.
Yep. Don't worry. She didn't have to do any strenuous research. She had a book off the shelf that she could pull down with recipes from 19th century naval beverages. So which 19th century naval drink does this wine least resemble? A, grog. B, insipisated juice of lime. C, syllabub. D, a shrub.
Grog.
The answer was C, syllabub.
Yeah, I don't know what the fuck syllabub is.
Like the rest of them, syllabub, she says, involves an acidic or citrus element, but unlike the rest, it involves cream, and this wine does not evoke creaminess or butteriness. She says that inspissated lime juice is basically lime syrup. Jamie should know what grog and a shrub are.
Yes.
Jamie, his whole attitude has just changed here now that he lost.
I got it wrong. I'm mad.
He's really upset.
I'm super mad.
All right. So next up, which of the following is not evoked by this wine? A, seeing your child waiting for the bus on their very first day of school in a non-pandemic year. That's ripped from the headlines, y'all, except for the non-pandemic year part. B, having had a mental picture of a sandy beach and being confronted with the reality of a jagged and rocky New England quote unquote beach.
Huh.
C, sitting on a flagstone patio in late August, stockpiling the feeling of end of summer sunshine on your skin.
I'm going to go with A.
The answer is A. Mm-hmm. Jamie got it. This moment is bittersweet, she says. This wine, while a little bitter, is emphatically dry. Side note, the bitter sour pairs a little better with pandemic back to school.
Yep.
Good one, wife.
Ripped from the headlines.
Straight from them. All right. And our last one, which of the following experiences pairs best with this wine? A, showing a seagull who's boss. B, showing a coworker who's boss. C, showing a mermaid who's boss. D, showing the beans who's boss. This is all her. I had nothing to do with this.
So hold on. The question was, what does it pair best with?
Which of the following experiences pairs best with this wine?
Okay.
So showing a seagull who's boss by beating it against a rock until it explodes.
Right.
In a cloud of blood and feathers and squawks. B, showing a coworker who's boss in the form of splitting their head open with a wet and gloopy axe. C, showing a mermaid who's boss.
Nope.
I'm going to just leave
that. We're not going to describe that one.
Just going to leave that one alone. And D, showing the beans who's boss. And the beans are metaphorical in the movie.
The beans are metaphorical. I'm going to go with the beans. Showing the beans who's boss.
The answer is, oh my God, she's so annoying. This isn't actually a multiple choice question. I'm just interested in seeing where you went with these options.
Wow.
Classic wife.
I'll say that showing anyone who's boss pairs well with this wine. The beans not being anything.
Why'd you spill your beans?
I didn't spill my beans.
Why'd you spill your beans? What do you think? Do you think it paired?
I do.
You think the wine pairs with showing somebody who's boss, but you think it pairs with the mood?
I think it pairs with the movie. I think it pairs aesthetically. Right. I think it pairs tonally mostly. And it's the screeching character of it and that tension that I talked about. I don't think it's a stretch to call this a tense movie. You've got the beginning part where it's normal-ish, despite all of the farts and the broad performances. And then
you mean it's normal in that there are no supernatural elements at all?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah. You know that there's a shoe that's going to drop.
Yeah.
It's a metaphorical shoe.
Something is going to happen. Seeds have been planted.
And
beans will be spilled.
Beans will be spilled. And what does happen is much more jarring than what probably anyone could imagine. But the tension continues to ramp up. Like, it's not a breaking of tension at that point in the middle. It's an amplification of it. And this wine that sort of like the texture of it and the acidity gives me in a similar way to the Fabrice Gasnier with Parasite.
Oh, so you had some synesthetic, some
amplified
shit going on.
The tension. Yes. That's what I think about the pairing.
I didn't have any experience like that. I think they went nicely together. Yeah, I don't have a lot to say about the pairing. I guess it works. I drank it while watching the movie. I put a whole bunch of it back. I don't have strong feelings one way or the other.
Having tasted the wine and enjoyed it, is there another movie that you would like to watch with it?
No. This part is hard.
Yep.
Pairing based on words is easy because it's inherently made up bullshit game that we're playing here.
Correct.
But at least with words, I have a pretty good grip on like
what the meanings of those words are.
For the most part.
Yes.
Yeah. But like tasting it and then picking something. No, I got no alternatives to go with this one. Yeah. I think it works. I like it. I liked them both. I liked them both separately. I liked them both together.
Yeah. I think it works, but we're moving right along. Next time on, Scotty.
Yeah, that's right, because we're doing more of these.
We're doing more of these.
Well, because, yeah, next time on this year, this will be part five.
Part five.
In the ongoing miniseries, Yeehaw, Jamie Sure Does Love Him Some Wine from Down Home America.
That's correct.
Wine and Jamie. Yeehaw, America. Fuck yeah.
Yes.
Manifest Destiny.
So we're doing...
So what's next time? What should everybody drink next time?
Next time, we're doing Anhill Farms Pinot Noir from Sonoma Coast, California. I fucking love that wine. I'm really excited to talk about it.
Anhill Farms. Am I going to like this, or is this going to be one of those ones that tastes bad?
It's a very, very good wine.
This
one and the next wine you're going to love.
Okay, good.
I love it. Every time I drink it, I love it more. Their single vineyard stuff is fucking insanity, and I can't wait until there's like aged examples. This is a pretty young producer, so nothing too old is available. So what did you pair?
No, Jamie.
Oh, what words did I give you?
What are the words? What are the pairing words?
Youthful, timeless, serious, and approachable.
Well, James, based on youthful, timeless, serious, and approachable, I have selected yet another great 2019 movie. I keep doing this. This is another one that like dominated the late 2019 and the 2020 award season. We're doing Little Women. This is the second feature film from Greta Gerwig. She directed it. She wrote it. She wrote the screenplay adapting from obviously the extremely famous and well-read by everyone except for me novel by Mary Louise Alcott. But yeah, The Little Women, it's the best movie.
You've said that a number of times.
But this one might be the best movie.
This is the best movie.
It's just so lovable. It's delightful and it's thoughtful and the performances are all great. I was just over the moon for it when I first saw it. And I think everyone should watch it if you haven't already. And if you have, then you should watch it again. Hey, everybody. Producer Scott here. Two quick corrections. First, we forgot to mention the vintage. For next time, we're drinking the 2019 Ant Hill Farm Sonoma Coast Pinot Noir. That one is available at Astor Wine and Spirits for $35. Second, you just heard me say that the novel Little Women was written by Mary Louise Alcott. Obviously, that is incorrect. It was written by Louisa May Alcott. Sorry about that. Apologies to the ghost and estate of Louisa May Alcott. Producer Scott, out. Jamie, you have extra homework. You have to watch Little Women and you have to watch Lady Bird as well.
Okay.
Because Lady Bird is her first film and I don't want to talk about one without talking about the other. And also Lady Bird is great.
Cool.
And Lady Bird will deeply upset you. It's a period piece set in the early 2000s when a high school senior struggles with her mom and her sense of future and her finances as she's about to graduate from high school in the summer of 2003.
Oh, fuck off. Fuck you.
It's a period piece.
Go fuck yourself.
Anyway, you should watch it because it's great. I think Lady Bird is on Amazon Prime. Little Women, as of this recording, is not available on any of the streamers. I think it's only available for those VODs. So, you know, just drop your $3.99 and check it out. I'm sure by the time this episode comes out, it will be available somewhere, and in which case we'll make a note or something.
Yeah, we'll let y'all know.
But you should watch it because it's the nicest movie and I love it and it's great.
I'm excited for it.
And it's only a little bit devastating.
Cool.
But like only a little bit.
Thanks, Scotty.
In like one part.
We really appreciate.
That's very devastating.
Your support to our emotional stability.
This movie wasn't devastating.
No, it wasn't.
No, it was not.
It was a delight.
But repulsive.
But also a delight.
Why'd you spill your beans, Jamie?
I didn't spill my beans.
Okay. I think we got to bring this home here, James.
We're bringing it home.
Let's wrap it up. Let's land this plane. Let's dock this ship.
Stop.
Let's maintain this lighthouse.
Thank you.
Let's
everyone.
Murder that seagull. Let's pound that cloaca.
For all of you that stuck with us through this episode, we really appreciate you. For those of you who didn't, you're gone, but we understand why.
I don't blame you.
Yeah, we don't blame you at all. Thanks for joining us. Please, everybody, follow us on the socials at BiggerBottlePod. If you have any questions or concerns, email us at BiggerBottlePod@gmail.com. Please, for the love of God, rate, review, and follow this show wherever you get your podcasts.
But especially, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts, which is like disproportionately important to podcasts. So go there, make the Apple account, please. Just help us out.
Help a couple of brothers out.
And if you write a nice or not nice review of the show, we'll read it on the air.
Yeah.
That's what we do. This episode was produced and edited by me, and Jamie handles all of our social media. That is Jamie over there. I am me right over here.
Remember, everyone, to drink more wine and watch more movies. It is good for you. We promise.
Please drink wine responsibly. Please watch movies irresponsibly. Jamie, why'd you spill your beans?
Drive fast and take chances. Later on, everybody.
Well, Jamie, don't spill your beans.